Jo, imasming dhamma vinaye appamato vihesati bahaya jati sangsaraṃ dukkhasantaṃ karissati ti. Yeah, after the Namo Tassa, I quoted that famous verse, the second half of the famous verse, which a previous disciple of a previous Buddha recited in the Brahmaloka, that it could be heard throughout the whole world system. Whoever in this Dhamma and discipline practices diligently, they will make an end to this endless circle of rebirth in samsara and will experience an end to all suffering. And I think this is a very inspiring message. And I'm sure many of you are happy to hear that, no? Because I could always relate to the teaching about abandoning suffering, because I can feel suffering in my heart. How about you? Do you feel sometimes pain, disappointment, hurt, fears, anxieties? Yeah. But this is the nature of particular human life. And if you're in Brahmaloka or even in the Devalokas, there's very little suffering. But in the human world, even if you're doing pretty well, there's still quite a bit of pain. And don't think you're the only one, because we are all in a habit, to pretend externally that all is fine and we're very happy. How are you? I'm fine. How are you doing? I'm great. This is how we constantly reassure each other, that we are happy and it's all good. And then we can sometimes end up with the idea, is something wrong only with me? Why does it hurt in here only for me? Don't think that. If you're a monk and people actually open up to you, you will notice, that even people where you wouldn't expect it, there's often a lot of pain. Whether it's a job and stress, whether it's in the family, whether it's sickness or a chronic pain condition, whether it is losing the job or being rejected, whether it's social anxiety or depression, mental disorder, or whatever disappointment, there's heaps. But the inspiring thing is, that the Buddha doesn't deny that. I mean, he first of all fully acknowledges that. And having fully acknowledged the fact, that there is a lot of suffering, and that there is, even if we don't experience much pain now, there's always death waiting, a new rebirth at some stage. And then to fully acknowledge that, and then secondly, to point out how we can get out of that. This is what I always found so inspiring. It's a little bit like going to the doctor. And if you have some pain in your body and after a while it doesn't get better and the pain gets worse, and you go to the doctor, and the doctor doesn't even look at you, doesn't do any lab test, doesn't do any examination, he tells you, no, it's all fine, it's all good. Would you be satisfied with that? No. A good doctor has to be realistic and he has to really check you out. And if you really have some genuine sickness or health condition, he has to openly tell you. Because unless we have a diagnosis, we cannot treat the sickness. And that shouldn't be perceived, as negative or pessimistic. The Buddha would acknowledge the situation which we feel. The Dhamma is for someone who feels like us, who can experience pain. But fortunately, the Buddha found the way out. And amazingly, the way out of suffering is not by changing external conditions. I'm sure you have already tried that, isn't it? You suffer, you're maybe not happy in your job, and you get another job. Is the suffering then gone forever? You're not quite happy with your partner, you get a new partner. Is the suffering now gone? Now you have some health condition, you get the doctor, you get treatment. Or there's someone in the family or at your job which makes life very difficult for you, who makes life very difficult. And then you're using whatever power and influence you have, or wheedling or arm twisting to change that person. Is that something you like to do, trying to change other people so that they are not causing you painful feeling? Very common. I also try to do that. It's a common natural response. We're always looking for an external cause for suffering. It's that person, the boss, the neighbor, the mother-in-law, the child that doesn't study and fails the exam, the politicians, the war, something outside, the weather too hot, too much rain, too dry, too much pollution. There's always something outside. And then sometimes we may be able to change that, at least partially or completely for a while. We may become good at manipulating or controlling other people, that they act in ways that are agreeable to us. We may be able to, if we have money, to create an environment which usually feels very pleasant and comfortable for us. But I wonder whether there's a single person here who has succeeded in controlling their environment to such an extent, and controlling other people to such an extent, that there is no more suffering for them. Has anyone succeeded with that for an extended period of time? No, not really, no. I mean, I know dedicated wives who have been married for decades and who have been working on their husband with great dedication for decades. And even they usually feel that the husband is still not quite the way they like him. So if a dedicated wife can't do that to the husband in decades, what are your chances that you can? I think we have 8 billion on this earth, human beings. What are your chances that you can change and control 8 billion human beings to act in such a way that it never causes you disappointment or suffering? Quite impossible. Quite impossible. So fortunately, the Buddha looked deeper. And you have probably heard about the Four Noble Truths. Ne? First Noble Truth, the truth of suffering, the pain we feel in our heart. And now the Buddha analyzed, like a good doctor, what is the deep cause. And what is the deep cause? Tanha, craving. Something inside, something in our heart, what we call defilements, what we call kilesa. You could also say ignorance, delusion. You could also say greed, hatred, delusion. This is actually, according to the Buddha's deep understanding, the real cause that we experience suffering. Once the Buddha made a proper diagnosis, like a good doctor, having properly identified the sickness, then he could provide a treatment plan for us. Just like once a doctor has found out maybe you've got pneumonia, bacterial pneumonia, then the doctor prescribes you antibiotics, staying in bed, resting, keeping warm, lots of fluids, in particular antibiotics, according to the prescription, you take them, and then the pneumonia will be cured. Exactly the same approach for the Buddha. He has identified in his own heart, but it applies to every being, that the cause of all the pain and suffering deep down is actually craving. And then he devised a treatment plan. He gave us a prescription. And if we properly follow that prescription, like I recited in the beginning, then we will be able to completely cure our heart from any pain. We will even be able to cure our heart from old age, sickness, death, and new rebirth. Well, that is possible. What is that prescription plan? Does anyone know? Yeah? The Noble Eightfold Path. Exactly. That's the prescription the Buddha has given us. And if we actually take the medication according to the prescription, then it will give good results. And we will experience the third noble truth, the end of suffering, the end of craving, which is the equivalent, that's the same. Once craving is gone, once delusion is gone in our heart, then our heart will be free from suffering. Now, however, we cannot eliminate craving just by an act of willpower. There's a gradual training. The Eightfold Path is something which we have to train over time, gradually, step by step. Actually, you can also summarize it as dana, sila, and bhavana. And the very first step, it may look a little bit daunting, to be able to remove all craving, all defilements, all illusion, delusion, ignorance in our heart. And it looks like a daunting task. But we do that step by step. And we start by what is called generosity, just simply being kind, sharing, giving, doing something for others. Because we are the first person who actually benefits from that. If we want to start reducing our suffering and experience more joy and happiness in our life, what I recommend is generosity and kindness. Actually, not so much I recommend that, but the Buddha recommends it. And all wise people, all great Kuba Ajans, all great teachers. And one thing which always appealed to me in the Buddha's teaching, you don't have to take that on pure faith. In fact, the Buddha actually encourages to try it out. He doesn't expect you that you just believe everything. Give it a try. For example, even giving a little bit of food to an animal. I'm sure you all have done that once. A little bit of some grains for the birds, feeding a cat. At Damagibi, we have these horses. That's the ideal situation. Looking after horses is really difficult, lots of work. But we have them adjusted. That means we have a contract with the neighbors, and we allow the horses to eat the grass on our property. But we have no duties. They even have to look after the fence, that the horses can't run away, and it's their horses. So I get only the good side. Occasionally I go to the horses, I grab some carrots, and I feed them. And it's really therapeutic. I can strongly recommend it. Now, just the simple act of feeding an animal. It's amazing how happy this big animal can be with just a few carrots. They love it. Just be careful, they may mistake your finger for a carrot. It happened once, this big Clydesdale. He thought my finger is also a carrot. That was a little bit painful when he chewed on my finger, but it's good fun eating, feeding animals. once you enjoy feeding animals, you may try out feeding monks. That can even be more fun. We may not be so cute as a cat, but we may have a bit better precepts, and maybe a little bit better understanding. So give it a try, and we understand that today at noon, people coming in, it's such an easy thing, so easy to try it out. They have even done studies on that. I remember once reading about a study in psychology, and that was about bonuses. Do you have this system also in Singapore? You may get a bonus at the end of the year, and some people get huge bonuses. In the finance industry, you may get a $1 million bonus, or you may get $1,000 or $10,000. And amazingly, they investigated how much happiness people reported and how it correlates to their bonus. And you may be thinking that the people who got a bigger bonus, the ones, say, who got 100,000, probably would be much more happy than someone who got a $10,000 bonus. And the ones who got only $1,000, probably not so much happiness. But the study showed something different. What do you think? Who was most happy with their bonus? It depended not so much on the amount. It depended how they spend it. And quite consistently in this study, the people who used their bonus to do something good for others, inviting friends for a nice meal, or inviting mother for a nice holiday, or giving that money to charity, apparently in this study they consistently reported greater happiness than the ones who spent the money on themselves. And even if you don't believe the study, try it out. Take $1,000, try some retail therapy, go into the nicest, latest shopping center here in Singapore, spend $1,000, come back with lots of bags, all stuff for yourself, and then maybe also wait a day and check out. Now, how do you feel now? Are you really much happier? Or take even only $100 and do something really nice for someone else. Buy a really good gift for grandfather or something like that. And then present the gift. And then maybe also wait a day, that it settles, and check out how much happiness from that. And doing these little experiments is an excellent way of motivating us. Do you sometimes struggle with motivation in your Dhamma practice? Making resolutions? Now, okay, Chinese New Year coming up. Do you also do a resolution like Westerners for the New Year? Is that a common thing? Oh yeah, next year I'll be meditating at least 1 hour every day. And here you go, the first 5 days, and then suddenly, oops. And then your regrets, and then you try to force yourself. A very good way of motivating yourself is noticing that Dhamma practice actually makes you happy. Noticing that being a good person feels good. Noticing, as you hopefully could feel in that metta meditation we did in the beginning, that wishing well to all beings unconditionally, including ourselves, feels really good. Because that's all it takes. Once you notice that practicing the Dhamma actually makes you happy and feels good here and now, not just once you die and then you're reborn in some beautiful Devaloka, Shangri-La. I mean, you get that as well. This is also quite real, very real. But still it's some distance. But I think the most powerful motivation is to experiment and mindfully observe what does Dhamma practice actually do to your heart here and now while you're doing it. Now this is how the Dhamma is na sanditiko, akaliko, pachatang veditapo. Naturally in the full nibbana, total enlightenment, total freedom from death and suffering, that can take some time to fully experience that. But the simple rewards the Buddha pointed out, which we can collect already while we are walking on the path, now that one we can already collect and we can check out here and now, directly visible, timeless in our own heart. Requires mindfulness. Now this is also a function of mindfulness. Now to notice how does it feel like when I practice a Dhamma, whether it's meditation, whether listening to a talk, whether listening to chanting, or whether doing a simple act of giving some food to an animal even. Have the mindfulness to carefully observe. Very important also in meditation. When you meditate, people tend to make the mistake that they try to focus, concentration. This English translation of samadhi can be a bit misleading. And people hear concentration, they over-focus. And you may end up with this, in inverted comma, a samadhi headache because you push your mind so much. Now try to give only maybe 2/3 of your energy, your focus to your meditation object. Now the rest you have in some nice, spacious, wider awareness. And the rest you also use for some general mindfulness, that you notice how your mind relates to the meditation object. Not just to the meditation object, anything in your Dhamma practice. Now when you do chanting, don't only do the chanting, have some mindfulness what the chanting is doing to your mind and how the mind feels when you're chanting. Have some mindfulness when you do your acts of generosity, when you're helping, when you're contributing, practicing generosity, how your mind experiences that, how it feels. That's a form of the second satipatthana, the second foundation of mindfulness, the mindfulness of feelings and mindfulness of the causes of feelings. Here in the cause, your own meditation, your own good actions, giving the result of a pleasant feeling here and now. And then you have got all the motivation you need. I'm not sure what's your favorite pastime. Eating your favorite food, do you need someone to tell you? You should eat your favorite food, eat more of your favorite food. Does anyone have to be nagging at you? Do you have to remind yourself and put reminders into your calendar and always push yourself to do your favorite activity? No, we do it all on ourselves. The motivation is very strong. The only danger is that this kind of pleasure can have a negative side effect, and we may have to stop ourselves doing what is so pleasant, because some of these worldly pleasant feelings can cause major problems. But we certainly don't need anyone pushing us or nagging us. We do it all on our own because it feels good. Once we notice that Dhamma practice feels good, you have all the motivation you need. And what's even better, the happiness we get from being a good person, from practicing loving kindness to all beings, from doing acts of charity, from keeping precepts, that happiness doesn't have all these bad side effects. It's a very curious thing how this is arranged. If it comes to worldly stuff, the nice food, partying, all these typical central indulgences, there's always this drawback, isn't it? The sweets may taste very nice, but the next time you go to the dentist, you have to pay for it. Sweets taste very nice, but if we overdo that, we may get diabetes and endless other kinds of sicknesses caused from this unhealthy nutrition with too much sugar. And of course, these substitutes are even worse. I think the Diet Coke is even more unhealthy than the real Coke, but sugar is really bad. And fascinatingly, almost all these worldly indulgences and sensual pleasures always have these drawbacks and dangers. And the nice thing, the Dhamma practice doesn't have that. There's no hangover. So you have a happiness that has no drawbacks, no hangover, and no bad side effects. And the only question that comes up, why do we not indulge in that more? What stops us from doing more generosity, from being more helpful, from doing more good actions? If it feels good for us, is good for others, and is actually the path of purification for our heart. So my recommendation, developing that mindfulness, and then just trying out, doing good things, and noticing how pleasant it feels. And before long, we will constantly looking for opportunities. If you heard of drug addicts, I don't think you have so many in Singapore with the strict laws, and how they always after the next shot of that drug, the next pill. Now, this is obviously very negative. But we can become a little bit like that also with good things. Once you notice how beneficial it is to yourself as well as to others to be a good person, you're always on the lookout to do more good. Becomes a self-reinforcing feedback loop, a feedback loop which is utterly wholesome. And you become kind of a marriage shark, always on the hunt for an opportunity. And when you hear one of these great Kuba ajans are coming, and you had so many in the last year, I think Lumpur Liem was here, Lumpur Tongdeng, Ajahn Keng, of course, and he comes regularly, and I can't remember, and there was many outstanding ajans. And if you once you get into this mode and you hear about it, you immediately think, wow, this is an opportunity to make more good karma. Can I somehow contribute and welcome the ajans, offer food, help with the preparations? Can I join the Dhamma talk? Can I participate in the meditation? You're looking for these opportunities because you're looking for your own happiness as the strongest motivation. And you may not believe me, but it's the same with precepts. That may not be so immediately apparent that if someone is starting keeping precepts, obviously if someone is an alcoholic, it will not feel immediately nice to keep the fifth precept. So for this more, we are moving into the little bit deeper practice. Doing something good, practicing kindness, generosity, and we can do that very quickly, very easy. The next step is a little bit more deeper in the transformation, and you have to give it a bit more time. But again, it's open to investigation. Try it out. If your precepts are not yet pure, the five, give it a try, even for starters, not just a week, what it feels like. We all know the five precepts, isn't it? Number one, not to kill any living beings. And that is any living beings. It includes animals, it includes insects. So if a mozzie is biting us, Shooing away is okay. Swatting is not okay. That would be breaking that precept. If we accidentally step on an ant, obviously we haven't broken the precept. There was no intention, we didn't even know maybe. But we wouldn't want to intentionally kill any living being. And it may come back to you as an amazing feeling of ease. I remember once in Singapore, and quite some time ago, years ago, I had one person attending the Dhamma talk later coming up and sharing that he had a fear, that she had a fear now of darkness. She was really afraid in the dark. Strange, irrational anxiety, like something is lurking in the dark. I was looking for advice, and I tried to give some advice. But interestingly, at a later occasion, another Dhamma talk, the same person talked about, regarding the first precept, that she felt that she has to keep her kitchen nice and clean. And she's using one of these very nice and clean looking sprays in nice clean colors and colorful and a nice name, but it's basically an insecticide. It's a poison to kill insects. And she liked to use it a lot, and she felt that this shouldn't be against the first precept and this is necessary to do. But what immediately struck me is a connection with that fear, that anxiety she also had. Because if you kill other beings, it may manifest as anxiety. And then in the dark, these beings seem to be lurking there. In the reality, that's all in the mind. It's not these beings really out there which you killed, but it's the weight on our conscience. And if we break the precepts, again, if we are mindful, this time I don't experiment, I don't recommend you to experiment with that. But you may remember it. Most people probably have broken any of the precepts in some past event. And even just remembering that, does it feel nice? Or does it feel like a burden on our mind? On the other hand, if we keep the precepts, we experience what the Buddha called avipatisara, the freedom from remorse. It's a very beautiful, uplifting emotion. It feels really good. And also, if you really keep the first precepts for a long time, it's a little bit like all beings are friends. Because for enemies, it takes two to be really enemies. And if you are committed to non-violence and not hurting or harming anyone, it doesn't necessarily mean that others may not still harm you. But emotionally, it actually feels like you don't have enemies because there's no enmity in you. And you feel much more at ease. So I can really recommend the first precept. Very beneficial to even overcome some forms of anxiety. Second precept, not to steal, not to take what is not given. If the handbag from the designer brand is too expensive, okay, we can't buy it, we can't pinch it. And we accept that, we have that contentment with our possessions. Do you know what is the karmic consequence of stealing in a future life? What will happen? The Buddha said, the loss of possessions. That is, if you're lucky enough that we make it to a human rebirth. Breaking the five precepts is always the biggest danger, as we may not be reborn as human. But if you are reborn as human, you may experience loss of possessions. And you can see in Australia, we sometimes have flooding, sometimes we have fires. And some houses, they are in a location, they may get flooded. And the neighbor, they may be fine. Same with the fires. So you wonder now why one person, not the other one, but one possible cause for that may be in the stealing in the past. Third precept, being faithful and loyal to one's partner, not to walk off with another person who may have another partner, another spouse, being committed in one's marriage. Do you know what is the karmic result of that one, breaking the third precept? Adultery and other forms of sensual misconduct? If one makes it to a human life in the next rebirth? Experiencing enmity, the Buddha pointed out. Have you ever seen that happening, that some people get hated on, apparently without reason? This sometimes happens, and it's fascinating. One person, for obscure reasons, apparently obscure reasons, they get really hated on. They have so much enmity that this is one possible cause. On the other hand, if we keep that precept pure, the opposite, you will not experience that so much. Fourth precept, not lying. Being truthful, committed to truthfulness. And the fifth one, not to take any drugs that cause intoxication. What is the worst drug causing the biggest damage worldwide every year? It's often not called a drug, it's often called champagne. It's called a 10-year-old special whiskey, alcohol. But this is actually the worst of all in terms of damage. So we have to be careful because some stuff is illegal, and then most people can easily understand this is dangerous. But in many societies, many Western societies in particular, alcohol is perfectly legal, advertised, and it appears like it's a good thing. No, but not. Very harmful. Why is alcohol so harmful? What's so bad about it? It destroys a sense of shame and conscience. And shame and conscience is a great restraint that stops us from doing bad things. And if you take alcohol, the sense of shame is gone. Nowadays you can see that very nicely on social media, the photos and the videos. So be careful with that one. At the time when you're doing that, I'm lucky, when I was young and unrestrained and not yet under five precepts as a layperson, there were no mobile phones around, so there's no footage of me doing silly things, but you are in danger nowadays. There's always some phone and someone taking the photos, and while you're intoxicated, you don't feel ashamed. The conscience is not kicking in and telling you, oh, this is not a good idea. But later, once you're sobered out, and then you see it, this is the main and the most important one. It also weakens mindfulness. Even in tiny amounts, it weakens mindfulness. And that will have a tendency to become permanent. It will not always come back. On the other hand, if you keep these five precepts, you get a sense of good mindfulness. You cultivate shame and conscience. You're committed to truthfulness. You're reliable, and the people recognize you as reliable, as honest. You don't experience enmity, but you will have harmonious relationships. You don't have loss of possessions, but particularly if you also practice generosity, you will be wealthy. And you will be long-lived. I notice many Chinese like to put this little figure, the symbol of longevity, the guy with the big forehead, How do you call him? The guy, the symbol for longevity. People put their statue into their homes. If you want longevity, I rather recommend the first precept. I think this is a safer bet than putting that figure. Don't kill any beings. And try out keeping these precepts and try out how it feels. In particular, if you do that for a longer time, try to really tune in. This is actually a meditation the Buddha recommended, particularly for the lay community. And he called that sila nusati, recollecting your virtue, recollecting your ethical conduct, your precepts which you have been keeping. And if you have been keeping truthfulness in the time when lies were ruling the world, remember that and you will feel very happy about that, that you could keep that truthfulness, that you didn't break that precept. Because when others lie, it's easy to join in and to stand out and to stay with truth. When the lies are ruling, this is a great act and very difficult to do, and then you feel very happy later when you recollect that. Now, when you see this war, it is very upsetting, and you may become depressed. But if you have good precepts and you ever feel depressed and seeing these awful wars and atrocities happening, don't always focus, don't watch that too much, but sometimes come back and remember that you are not harming anyone. Remember that for a long time you have been keeping this precept, that you're committed to that. And then you can come out of this overwhelming depression of witnessing all these atrocities. Now the Buddha said, there's a way around killing, and that is, I am not going to kill. There's a way around violence, and that is, I am committed to be non-violent. Now, we may not be able to change the whole world and stop all wars, but if we can stop at least being violent ourselves, that is a great accomplishment, and it will give you a sense of wholesome accomplishment whenever you feel down. So keep these precepts and remember them. Feel it out with mindfulness. What does it feel like to remember how you keep these five precepts? Not killing, not stealing, committed to your spouse, to your partner, not destroying another marriage or partnership, being truthful, whatever others may be saying, and being sober, being mindful, having a sense of shame and conscience. The Buddha also called that anavajrasukha, the blameless happiness. And that's really there for taking, that's for experiencing. And unfortunately, sometimes people keep the precepts, but they're neglecting reflecting on it. They're not arousing sufficient mindfulness to notice how much happiness that is. And a clear conscience, how enjoyable that is, how uplifting. Because if we want to go to the next step, bhavana, developing samadhi, you may have tried sitting, and do you find it easy? Just a few hours, only the breath, focusing on the breath, not thinking about anything else, staying with a meditation object, for hours until you unify your heart in samadhi and bliss. It's not super easy, But it becomes easier if you already have this happiness in your heart from being a good person and having made good karma, punya, and keeping precepts. Now this is what builds up the background happiness in our heart. And then when you start focusing internally, you will encounter all the punya you made, all the precept you kept, which prevented you from doing anything bad, from making any bad karma. You will encounter that as brightness in your heart and happiness. If you try to meditate, to focus internally, and there's lots of restlessness, you feel quite unhappy inside, there seems to be darkness, now then we have to make an effort to make more punya, to continue accumulating good actions. We have to further purify our precepts, you know, to increase this background happiness, that background lightness. Now, Singapore is pretty high-tech. Do you still get your bank account statements by mail? Or you do that all online? Eh? Do you occasionally check your account? Or is it something you're not interested in? I don't mind how much money I have there on my account. Or do you keep an eye on that? It's a good idea to keep an eye on it, because what happens if your expenses exceed your income? You work your job, you get your monthly, is Singapore monthly payment or weekly? Australia still has weekly. Monthly, no? That's what I remember from Germany. So you get whatever, 3,000 or even 5,000 Singapore dollars every month. And then you enjoy going into the shopping centers, nice and cool, no? And all these nice things, and you shop, and you have 5,000 a month income, and you spend 10,000 a month in the shopping centers and for your other stuff. Is it going to work? No, you get into trouble. So this is why you check your account. How about your karmic balance sheet? What is that looking like? What is the balance here? No? The bottom line. You know that expression, the bottom line on the balance sheet? Is it unimportant? The bottom line in your karmic balance sheet, is that unimportant? No, I would suggest it's even more important than the bottom line on your account. Ne? Because what happens if you have a negative bottom line, more debts than assets, more bad karma than good karma, and then you die? Ooh. Going to a bad place, no? We wouldn't want that to happen. So how do you check your karmic balance sheet? Do they have an app on that in the Play Store or the App Store? So you see, you can't do everything with a gadget. So how do you check your karmic balance sheet? If you sit very quietly, and you look inside, that gives you some idea. If a person really has kept precepts not only in this lifetime, but even lifetimes before, and has done lots and lots of good karma in this lifetime and lifetimes before, they will have a very, very bright and happy heart. And when they tune into that, it feels very good. Someone like Venerable Sariputta, he was that kind of person. Very few defilements, so much good karma. And so what you encounter there, when you simply sit quiet and you start looking inside, that often gives you some idea. Of course, not to worry you too much, there's also the fact that people are quite distracted. And the first thing you encounter is usually all the echoes from the distraction throughout the day. So this is not so much what I mean. You have to wait till this settles down a bit, and then you get some feeling. It's also changing a little bit from events during the day. So you have to feel that out with a little bit of patience repeatedly and after the mind has settled. But this is what gives you some idea. And if it doesn't look so good, and if it's a little bit too dark and doesn't feel so nice inside, then we have to make more good karma, keep better precepts. until the hardener becomes naturally brighter. This is actually more important than the technique you're using to meditate. This is more important than trying to force yourself to sit a certain amount of time during the day. And if someone lives their life in a killing, stealing, adultering, lying, and getting sloshed, and hurting and harming others and not doing any good actions, now that person, even if they force themselves under the guidance of great meditation masters to sit 2 hours meditation every day, they will not achieve samadhi. I can't see that happening. The samadhi is the end result of a very bright, joyful heart from precepts, from punya, from being a good person. Once these conditions are there, then the meditation will progress quite nicely. If that not is there, you can't do that with just forcing yourself to concentrate and trying the different techniques. Of course, it is also important to do that because it's an additional condition for the heart to really settle down. But people often overemphasize the technique. They believe too much in the technique and they believe too much in the act of formally sitting, and they're neglecting the general purification. Developing samadhi means overcoming the 5 hindrances of sensual desire, aversion, laziness, tiredness, restlessness, and doubt. And that is something we have to do throughout our life, whether we sit in formal meditation or whether we are living our daily life. If we have to change our thinking, we have to think thoughts of kindness, thoughts of letting go, thoughts of compassion. And once the proportion of these wholesome thoughts is very high, then we can use a suitable meditation object like metta. I really recommend metta. And may all beings be happy and well. You just stay with that. Based on that pure precepts, based on all the good karma you have made. And then the heart finds it easy to stay with that thought because your mind already inclines to wholesome and good thoughts. You find it easy to think that, to feel that, to intend that. And then the happiness you already have in your heart, the brightness from precepts and being good and making good karma, combines with the happiness you feel here and now from wishing everyone well, from developing unconditional, non-judgmental loving kindness to everyone without any expectation, no distinction. And then the happiness in your heart is so great that the heart will unify in bliss. The hindrances now overcome. And you experience samadhi. And once the heart experiences samadhi and unifies in rapture and bliss, and then you come out of that, that is a good basis to look again at the cause of suffering. It's actually quite amazing that the best basis, the best foundation to investigate and truly understand suffering is once your heart is really blissed out in samadhi. When you're depressed, when you suffer, say, from clinical depression, a major depressive disorder, it is often counterproductive to try to contemplate Four Noble Truths because the suffering is too powerful. We first have to do this gradual training, and once the heart is happy and at ease and blissed out in samadhi, now you look at the causes of suffering. And then you can see it very clearly. And then you can see the craving in your heart. And then you can see that connection. This is all that is required in your insight, that you see that the craving you have, the kilesas in your heart, actually cause that suffering. It's just like putting your hand into fire. Maybe Singapore, you don't have much fire, but maybe you have got this electric stove in your home. And it's usually, you know, these, how do you call that, these plates who get hot. And sometimes you may not be aware that this thing is hot and you touch it. If you touch the hot plate on your stove, what do? You pull back immediately. Why? Very painful. And you know, you see, without any doubt, the cause of that pain is that this plate is hot and you have touched it. This is why you immediately pull back. However, you don't see with the same clarity that the craving in your heart is the cause for the pain you're feeling. That one you don't see so clearly. This is why you don't let go. If you accidentally touch the hot plate on your stove, do I have to come as a monk and tell you, this hurts, you should pull that back? You do that all on your own because it's so obvious. The cause of that pain, the burn, is this hot plate, so you pull back. Now for the noble ones who have understood the Dhamma, the connection between craving and the pain in their heart is just as obvious. This is vipassana, this is the insight. It's nothing very obscure or exotic. It's the same old thing from the second noble truth, third noble truth, is what the Buddha talks about. It's just that you can actually clearly see it. Just like with that hot plate. And that clear seeing is enough. You see the cause of all this pain in your heart. You see, it is not the job, it is not the politicians, it's not the family, it's not the child, it's not this or that. It's that very craving in your heart. With that clarity you see it, and the result of that is letting go. The heart lets go as a result of that wisdom and insight. It comes automatically. You don't have to do anything to let go, it comes as a result of that clear seeing, that insight. That causal connection clearly identified and seen in your heart with true wisdom as it truly is, and the letting go occurs. And once you let go completely of craving, that's it, no more suffering. And that feels really good. Ask anyone who has experienced that. Now ask the great Kupa Ajahns. Ask what the Buddha said. When that craving is gone and your heart is completely free, and no more suffering is there, and no more suffering can ever arise again. Now this is what we are practicing for. This is why we practice generosity, virtue, samadhi, insight, to see that connection that we can let go. And then the heart is all free from suffering. And no suffering can come back into the heart ever again. So, let us all make a decent effort, because as I quoted in the beginning, yo imasming dhamma vinaye appamatto vihasati pahaya jati sangsaram dukkhasantam karisati. Anyone who truly practices diligently in this dhamma and discipline, having abandoned repeated birth and sangsara, they definitely will make an end of all pain and suffering. Thank you.